Modern Love, the podcast, is supported by...
This podcast is supported by Cartier. In celebration of the Trinity Collection's 100th anniversary, Cartier shares testaments of love in all its forms from around the world. Please keep listening for today's love story later in this episode.
Produced by the iLab at WBUR, Boston.
From the New York Times and WBUR Boston, this is Modern Love. Stories of love, loss, and redemption. I'm your host, Meghna Chakrabarty. How do you fall in love again after loss? How do you deal with the complicated, conflicting emotions that come from grieving one person and also opening yourself up to loving someone else? That's what Brendan Halpin explores in his essay. It's called Dedicated to Two Women, Only One of Them Alive. It's read by Terry Crews. He stars in Brooklyn Nine-Nine on NBC.
My wife is about to die. As I leave the hospice to pick up our daughter at school, I tell Kirsten I love her. She is bald, gaunt, jaundiced, and slipping in and out of consciousness. It takes a lot of effort for her to speak. I love you, I tell her, and she surfaces briefly and croaks, I love you too. It's the last thing she will ever say to me. I take our 7-year-old daughter, Rowan, from school to the hospice for a brief visit. And later that night, I go back alone and sit by Kirsten's bed with her parents and sister. Kirsten is unconscious, rasping and moaning with every breath. Sometimes there is a long pause between her breaths, and though it has become clear to me that prayer is ineffective, each time this long pause happens, I just pray that she's dead because I can't stand for her to be alive like this. I fall asleep holding her hand. And I wake up at 1 in the morning. I tell Kirsten's family I have to leave because Kirsten and I agreed in advance that it was important for me to be with Rowan at bedtime and in the morning. I kiss Kirsten goodbye, and 5 hours later, it is Kirsten's parents and sister who are with her, singing as she dies, and not me. I know I did what Kirsten wanted, but still, we were together for 14 years. I wish I had been there. Weeks later, I have a dream. Kirsten, Rowan, and I are in the same mall where Kirsten and I went walking to try to get her contractions restarted on the frigid January day when Rowan was born. There's a bookstore on the 3rd floor, and Kirsten and I take escalators all the way up. Suddenly, I realize I don't know where our daughter is. "Where's Rowan?" I ask Kirsten, beginning to panic. She's unfazed. I guess she's still down by the bathrooms. "Well, I have to go get her," I say. And as I get to the elevator, I see Kirsten heading into the bookstore. On the ground floor, I get off the elevator and find Rowan. I throw my arms around her and wake up. I'm at home, in my bed, where I need to be, with the living and not the dead. I am annoyed with my subconscious for choosing the mall as a metaphor, though I am comforted by the idea of the afterlife as a bookstore. If that's true, I'm sure Kirsten is content. Of course, I don't really believe that's where she is, but she's certainly not here. Oh, I have some of her ashes with us in Boston, and since I gave out baggies of ashes like party favors at her funeral, she's in the ocean and in Georgia, Virginia, Pennsylvania, Illinois, and California. I will never again hear the ZZ Top song, "I'm Bad, I'm Nationwide," without thinking of Kirsten. But while some people talk about feeling the presence of their loved ones after their deaths, that's not the case for me. Kirsten is bad, she's nationwide, and she's completely gone. I can get through the days on automatic pilot, but at night, when I'm not crying, I'm furious that my daughter will never have anything but a 7-year-old's knowledge of her mother, that so many evil, humorless clods are still living while my whip-smart wife with the razor wit is not. My daughter lives in the moment, makes me laugh and gives me a reason to get out of bed in the morning. But now even the most mundane parenting decision becomes fraught with significance because it reminds me I have to make every decision on my own. Nobody else to consult, commiserate with, or blame. I need a distraction. So I fixate on the idea of getting a date. Kirsten half seriously told me I could start dating after 2 years, and it has only been 5 months. But she also told me that the only thing that would make dying unbearable was thinking that Rowan and I would be unhappy forever. You have to be happy, she told me. You have to. I think it might make me happy to have a date. So I decide the serious instruction to be happy trumps the half-serious dating timetable. I spend a week going through the humiliating process of creating an online personal ad. I write a desperate, needy, excessively long response to a woman who has a snarky sense of humor and bears a somewhat disturbing resemblance to Kirsten. Mercifully, she doesn't write me back. I then spend a couple of weeks exchanging email messages with an attractive single mom. The email messages lead to a phone call in which she talks about how difficult it is to date. And I get scared and don't ask her out because I realize I don't even really know what dating is. I met Kirsten in college. I've never dated as a real adult. It appears that it's terrifying and stressful. The hell with it. Another month goes by, making 7 since Kirsten died, and I've given up on getting a date anytime soon. I do, however, sometimes have nice conversations with Suzanne, a teacher at Rowan School, a single parent like me who is outside doing bus duty at drop-off. I think she's cool and smart and sexy, and she confirms all 3 when she tells me that she's going to a rock and roll camp for women over April vacation. I am convinced that someone as alluring and joyful as she is could never be interested in anyone as awkward and depressed as I am, but these morning conversations do feel flirtatious. When she comes back from rock camp and gives me the lyrics to a song she wrote, I think, am I crazy? Or does she like me? I give her a copy of my novel, but I don't inscribe it because I'm paralyzed trying to think of what to write. She emails me to tell me she likes the novel, and then our email messages become phone calls, and we spend hours on the phone every night. I start mixing CDs for her. My friends say that's cute, and aren't we just like a couple of teenagers? I tell them that 2 single parents trying to date are a lot like 2 teenagers trying to date, except that the people preventing us from leaving the house at night are much smaller. Eventually, we both get some babysitting, and we have a date. It's a walk in the park, which quickly turns into sitting in the park, and before long, I am kissing a woman other than my wife. It feels good, and I don't feel guilty. The phone calls continue, and we have a couple of family dates where Rowan and I get together with Suzanne and her 2 kids. And after one of them, Rowan says to me, are you going to get married again? I don't know, I say. I mean, maybe someday. Well, you know, she says, this business can't go on forever. This business with Suzanne? No, she says to me in that you are so dumb I can't believe it tone with which all parents are familiar. This business of not having a wife. Late one night, after agonizing about it for days. Do I really? Yeah. Is it time? Maybe. Will I scare her off? Probably not, but maybe. Am I really sure? Yeah. I tell Suzanne that I love her. What did you say? You're mumbling. I repeat myself, trying my best to articulate and project. I love you. I feel relieved and happy, but also guilty. For 14 years, those words belonged only to Kirsten, but now they also belong to Suzanne. And so, for the first time in my life, I find myself in love with two women at the same time. If both were alive, this would constitute a pretty serious problem. But here's the thing. I'm down here in the mall, and Kirsten is up in the bookstore. It would be a stupid waste of time for me to stand here on the ground floor staring longingly at the bookstore when I found somebody to go to the Orange Julius with. A month later, I am invited to the wedding of a former student. Suzanne agrees to be my date, and we get all dressed up. She looks breathtaking, and we drive to the church. We sit with a group of my former students, and they hug me. They are laughing and joking, and I feel proud to be with Suzanne, proud to be invited to this wedding, and happy to see so many people who have been so important to me. But when the bride and groom arrive at the altar, I feel my chest tightening, my heart racing, and my tear ducts itching. I feel like jumping out of my skin, running from the church to save myself. I actually don't know why until the bride and groom are saying their vows. And suddenly I am back in a different church 10 years ago, swearing to Kirsten and God and a church full of people that I will love and honor her in sickness and in health until death do us part. I was only 26 and didn't understand, didn't believe that the sickness and death parts of those vows would come true so horribly soon. The bride and groom walk out arm in arm. The happy music plays. The attendants stream down the aisle with big, goofy smiles on their faces, and I am lurched back into the present, surrounded again by people I love, holding the hand of one of the women I love, the one who's here and looking at me right now with concern. Suzanne gives my hand a squeeze. "Are you okay, sweetie?" "Yeah," I say. "I think so."
That's Terry Crews reading Brendan Halpin's essay, dedicated to two women, only one of them alive. We'll catch up with Brendan right after this.
Hi, I'm Josh Hayner, and I'm a staff photographer at the New York Times covering climate change. For years, we've sort of imagined this picture of a polar bear floating on a piece of ice. Those have been the images associated with climate change. My challenge is to find stories that show you how climate change is affecting our world right now. If you want to support the kind of journalism that we're working on here on the Climate and Environment desk at the New York Times, please subscribe on our website or our app.
Brendan Halpin's essay was published in December 2004. It was only the sixth essay ever published in the Modern Love column. And he updated us on what happened next for him and Suzanne.
Suzanne and I were married in 2005. We're still married. We raised three children together, my biological child and her two biological children. And, you know, it's awesome. Clearly, I made the right call. I certainly hope that she feels the same way. I hope she does. I think she does. You know, so I don't have any updates on my love life, which is fantastic. Nothing incredibly earth-shattering, fortunately. My world was shattered plenty, you know, in the early 2000s, so I'm happy to have a relatively boring middle-aged existence right now.
At this point, Brendan and Suzanne have been together for as long as he and Kirsten were.
What I miss about Kirsten most is, I think, just sort of the friendship element and, you know, the fact that we really grew up together. We got together when, you know, we were 19 and, you know, she died at 35. So those are very eventful years of, like, becoming an adult. What I feel more than a longing for her presence is just an anger at everything that she missed. She never got to see Rowan become an adult, and Rowan's an awesome adult. All my kids are awesome adults, but just, you know, it's not fair that she died at 35 and that she suffered so much in dying.
And Brendan says that he struggled with how to move on after Kirsten's death.
I kept talking in therapy about what do I owe Kirsten? And the therapist was wonderfully blunt and was like, she's dead. You don't owe her anything. And I was like, well, she's like, what? How's she going to collect? Like, she's dead. So that's a little harsh. It sounds a little harsh, but it's really true. You know, your relationship with that person ends the moment that they die. And everything else is about you and how you're feeling. And so it's usually less the widows and stuff and maybe more peripheral people who see it as some sort of betrayal, you know. But it's not a betrayal. It's a wonderful thing to be able to find love again. And that if you've come to know that the person you love can be taken from you at any moment, how long are you supposed to wait?
Brendan also says that he doesn't want listeners to think that this is just a story about Kirsten.
It's also a story about Suzanne, and I just, you know, she has, I tell her all the time that she saved my life, and I don't want to understate or have people come away from this thinking that she's less important, because she's enormously important to my life, and I am thankful every day that she's in it and that she's given me this new lease on life and love that I didn't expect to ever have.
And losing Kirsten has made Brendan think about his marriage to Suzanne differently.
Once you know that someone can be taken from you, like, you can't lose that. So, I mean, I certainly did take Kirsten for granted, not in a way of, like, not paying attention to her or anything like that, but I just figured, you know, we got married and we had a kid and that was it, and we were going to be together forever, and then we weren't. And so I'm constantly aware with Suzanne that I'm not guaranteed any more time with her. And so it's definitely informed the way that I act with her and the way that I feel about our marriage. I'm constantly appreciative that she's still with me and still here.
Brendan Halpin. He's written 18 books, including It Takes a Worried Man. He lives in Boston. More after the break.
Hi, I'm Josh Hayner, and I'm a staff photographer at the New York Times covering climate change. For years, we've sort of imagined this picture of a polar bear floating on a piece of ice. Those have been the images associated with climate change. My challenge is to find stories that show you how climate change is affecting our world right now. If you want to support the kind of journalism that we're working on here on the Climate and Environment desk at the New York Times, please subscribe on our website or our app.
Here's Terry Crews on why he wanted to read this story.
I've been married for 30 years, and we are getting up in age, and our kids are grown. And, you know, one thing about, you know, being 51 is that you start to recognize your own mortality. And I've often wondered, you know, what would I do when Rebecca's gone? The biggest thing that really hit me was just, I want to go first. You don't know. You just don't have any idea. But what would I do if Rebecca wasn't here? And this really touched me. And it touched me about this man starting again, deciding to move on. Would I want my wife to move on? What if the roles were reversed? How would I feel about Rebecca remarrying? And these were really, really intense, deep conversations I had with myself after reading this. And I thought, this is a story I need to read to deal with my own fears. I can't imagine I just can't imagine anyone else. Like, for me, you just think I wouldn't be, I don't know if I could do it. But then you know, this, you do, you can move on and fall in love again. You know what I mean? And I was like, oh, but I don't know if I'd want to. You know what I mean? It's just so wild. It's so many emotions, so many feelings. I think the story is so complex because it deals with, you know, our humanity at its core.
Thanks to Terry for reading this week's essay. He stars in Brooklyn Nine-Nine on NBC. And here's Daniel Jones, editor of the Modern Love column for the New York Times.
Brendan's essay was published more than 15 years ago. And this was really back when I was trying to figure out what the column could be. You know, it may seem obvious what it is now, but at the time it was like, what is love and what are the parameters of what this column is? And I think Brendan's essay pushed it open in a new direction in this, you know, this sort of devastating combination of grief and humor and being open to the possibility of new love and having a daughter with her sort of quirky personality. You know, I really credit him for being so open about such a fragile emotional experience and just getting it down there and in a way teaching me what the Modern Love column could be and what it could take on.
Modern Love is a production of the New York Times and WBUR, Boston's NPR station. It's produced, directed, and edited by Caitlin O'Keefe. Original scoring and sound design by Matt Reed. Iris Adler is our executive producer. Daniel Jones is the editor of Modern Love for the New York Times and advisor to the show. The idea for the Modern Love podcast was conceived by Lisa Tobin. Special thanks to Julia Simon, Anya Stremian, and Mia Lee at the New York Times. Additional music courtesy of APM. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. My other job is hosting an NPR show called On Point. Check it out in your podcast feed. See you next week.